I have the pleasure of talking today to Dr. Paul Sieber from Urological Associates of Lancaster. Paul is well known to our audience here in Lancaster because he's been practicing urology since 1988 with UAL. And you came here, Paul, from your residency at Hershey. So let me welcome you to the microphone and ask you to give us just a little bit of background about your education and how you made your way to Hershey, Pennsylvania before coming to Lancaster.
Well, I'm originally a Hoosier. I went to undergrad at Purdue, and I went to medical school at Indiana, and I got to Hershey because Indiana at that point had been kind of a breeding ground for the Hershey staff, so that's why I ended up at Hershey to do my training. And never really had any intention of even settling in Pennsylvania, but I rotated down here when I switched from general surgery into urology and spent 6 months with my group and was very enamored with the hospital and what it had to offer and what I considered basically tertiary care level medicine at a non-academic medical center. And I guess it was the academic tendencies of my group that made me say, I want to join these guys, and here I am 20 years later.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the academic tendencies of your group, because listening to your background, your training, and so on, it sounds very much like exactly what the rest of us go through in terms of medical school and residency, and yet you ended up with a career that is so much more oriented towards clinical research than most people. And that, of course, is why we're talking to you today, because we want to explore the pathway that led you towards these interests. And I guess I should point out right here at the beginning the evidence for your activity. Looking at your CV, one sees that you've been engaged over the years in close to 100 clinical multi-institutional collaborative trials. I know at any given time you've always got scores of them that are active. You've published well over 30 papers in peer-reviewed journals and probably are acknowledged in many more. Let me ask you how you really got started with your interest in all of this research in what is, after all, just a community hospital.
Well, I guess it was partly just luck. You know, when I was in college, I spent a couple of semesters working with a parasitologist, just doing some basic lab bench research looking at schistosomiasis. And then I went from that to medical school. In my senior year, I spent a couple of months with a pediatric surgeon doing some, again, stuff on the bench model in terms of necrotizing enteral colitis in an animal model of that. So I had some basic understanding of research that kind of intrigued me. But then that was pretty quiet, and when I got to my residency days, Hershey wasn't particularly noted for doing clinical research. We didn't have a lot of things running in the urology department, and so that phase of my training research was pretty much quiescent. And then I guess just by luck, I came here, and I guess it was the end of my first year here, there was an M&M conference, and I had a complication related to a surgical patient. And someone stood up and said, hey, listen, you know, you did it the wrong way, and I was somewhat incensed to say, what do you mean I did it the wrong way? I didn't train where you did. How do you know you're right? So I sat down and looked at some surgical patients that had had pelvic lymphadenectomy associated with their prostate cancer when I was in residency. And what I found was that I had ample data to say that the way I did the procedure was correct, but we had a higher incidence of pulmonary emboli and DVT than we ever thought. And just as luck would have it, there was a proposal for people in private practice from the American Foundation for Urologic Disease, which is now part of the AUA, to grant a dozen grants for doing studies specifically for people in private practice. So I submitted a grant application and I won. So I wrote that grant up and ultimately got that published a few years later, and then I was kind of off and running. And I didn't realize what weight there was to having this grant attached to my name. It opened doors that I just never expected. So I actually went to a couple of pharmaceutical companies and said, hey, listen, would you fund me to do just some small clinical studies, which somewhat to my surprise, they said yes. And once again, they got published. And then people started knocking at the doors. And then I was off and running and things just seemed to kind of roll along. And I guess I had a natural curiosity, which seemed to push me to a much higher level. And now all of a sudden I'm looking at trials and I'm looking at the actual running of the study in terms of the actual trial design, and people come to me before this study even starts to say, what do you think about our trial design? And I'm kind of at the top of the heap now.
Well, in order to do all of this in the setting of an active clinical practice, because you are an active clinical urologic surgeon, do you segregate time out? I mean, I'm just thinking that people in the audience are thinking to themselves, well, he's got some kind of a special arrangement with his group, or how could you possibly have time for all of this? So give me some idea of how you've structured your career that enables you to do this. Do you have staff that's supported by money from some of these studies? And do you have time that your practice gives you because you're doing this kind of work?
It started out small. So I initially had a nurse in the office giving me a hand filling out all the paperwork. And it was just, it was my spare time. And then it got a little busier, so my part-time nurse, so I hired a full-time nurse. And that got a little busier yet, and so I went to the group and I said, you know, will you support this? And my group wholeheartedly supported it. And they, in turn, provided patients. I would, you know, present a study to them, and they provided patients, and they provided me the time to travel, because I'd probably say, on the average, I'm probably out of town probably one weekend a month for my studies. So it got busier and busier, and now it's just become basically a part of my practice. You know, the studies we do are all clinical trials that are relevant to our standard practice. So it's not terribly challenging to incorporate the day-to-day into the practice. It does take a fair amount of extra work. I devote a lot of extra time. My spare time is my clinical trials and my research. But it's also been my practice has supported it, and I've gotten big enough, and there's enough support from it that I have, you know, a manager of clinical research, I have three nurses, I have a data entry person, we have a full lab in our office, so we process our own samples, you know, as much as we even make our own dry ice. We do a lot of our own diagnostic studies in the office, whether it's an EKG, a DEXA scan, ultrasound, so it's just morphed into my own.
Now, this infrastructure that you describe with managers, nurses, etc., they are paid for by funds that come as a result of your participating in the trials? They come from drug companies?
I was fortunate that everything fell into place for me, because if you look at clinical trials of 25, 30 years ago and government funding, that's kind of become a thing of the past. So in my discipline, at least, the majority of studies are coming from industry. They are the basic providers of the monies, and we are paid roughly on par with what I would describe as a typical private insurance payer in terms of what we get. So out of that money, I'm able to divvy up the cost of my staff, my infrastructure, out of that income. But it's pretty much relevant to anyone else out there that it's going to generate revenue somewhat akin to what you'd get from a private pay patient.
But you, of course, have to spend a lot more time talking to people if you want to enroll them in a randomized study. They're obviously skeptical, and we've all enrolled patients in randomized studies, and it takes extra time. Now, that's where your staff comes in as well, I'm sure.
Oh, there's no question that it took a lot of years of effort to get the machine greased to run smoothly. It takes effort. I mean, if you don't have the drive to do it, or the interest or the curiosity, you're not going to find this is some easy, simple task to undertake. It takes a lot of effort. But I think there's incredible rich rewards once you get there that are not necessarily monetary. I mean, when it comes to cutting edge and understanding where are we going, where are there problems, where are there unmet needs, you can make a huge difference. I mean, all of a sudden, you know, articles that I've written or studies I participated in are setting new trends in terms of how we treat patients. That's just tremendously exciting to say, I'm making a difference not only in delivering what I hope is superb care to my patients in Lancaster, but I'm making a difference nationally and internationally. I mean, I'm suddenly asked to review articles from journals in the U.S. and outside the U.S. And I'm a private practitioner in Lancaster reviewing articles for all kinds of different journals as a private practitioner.
I recall a conversation we had in which you described to me your early exposure, which was a lot different from mine because I was in an academic setting before I came here. So I was always involved in trying to get something published and seeing the rewards. And that's a little bit different. And in fact, in academics, if we publish a paper, we call it making money. as that's the coin of the realm in academics, is your publications. But for you, in private practice, tell me again this story you told me in another setting about the first time you got involved with Proscar and prostate bleeding and realized that you could have an impact just from clinical observation.
That was my second piece of information that I was able to gather, publish, and say, wow, I've done something. And it was about a dozen years ago when we were starting to just notice that clinically, when we had people with prostate bleeding, this new drug, Proscar, now it's the generic finasteride, had an effect on control of prostate bleeding. I thought that was kind of a big deal, and my partners, I said, you know, gee, guys, we've got a handful of patients, we ought to write this up. And so, you know, about 10 years ago, we submitted a publication, it got accepted, and here's our Proscar controls prostate bleeding. Well, you know, in that year, there were a couple publications, ours being one of them, and now here we are a decade later, and the AUA guidelines that talk about treatment of BPH list prostatic bleeding, which was, when I was in my residency, an indication for prostatectomy. Now the treatment of choice is Proscar, and if they are unresponsive to that therapy, they go on to have a prostatectomy. And so to suddenly see something that I've written up that I thought was just kind of an interesting anecdotal review of a few dozen cases now is in the guidelines for the treatment of patient care is amazing. Just like I talked to you the other day, too, about how we reviewed our data on prostate biopsy and wrote that up. If you look at the AUA guidelines for antibiotic prophylaxis and the references they cite our prostate biopsy infection paper. It was 4,500 patients, although it was typical of how difficult it is from the private sector. I wrote that paper up. I reviewed 4,500 patients that we had done prostate biopsy on our infection rate. And the first reviewer came back to me and said, I don't believe you did this. So I said, fine, I'll send you the tapes and you can do all the queries yourself because here's our database and we thought this was important to track this information and it got published and now it's the largest publication ever done in terms of a sheer number of patients in one setting. So it was pretty exciting.
Well, I'd like to focus on the point you just made about the database because that is unquestionably the weak link for most people who want to look at their results and they don't have the data. And as you know, when we came here to start the heart surgery program, we started a database from the first case. And I insisted on that, and I insisted that the hospital collaborate with us to do that. And of course, now you have to have that information, and we have the PHC-4. But it is disturbing to me that more practices don't see the need to keep a record of all of their cases, because if you want to improve your outcomes, the number one way to start doing that is to go back and look at your results. And if you don't have the data, you can't look at your own results. The message I'm getting from you is that this approach towards looking at results, comparing results, and so on, yes, it must be enormously gratifying to you, but it must also have an impact on your own group's practice. That has to be another very important benefit of doing it.
Oh, I think there's no question that ultimately we adopt things as a group because I've got the database or I look at something and I say, we'll study this and we adopt patterns of practice because someone says, we're not doing it all in a uniform manner. It's better if you all do this. And I think it's so easy when you're out 20 years to coast along and say, we did it this way 20 years ago and you're practicing the very best medicine from 20 years ago. So when you look at doing clinical trials, it's just an amazing CME experience that I don't know how anyone else keeps up. I don't know how the average guy can keep up with all the stuff that's going on. And I find that my exposure is particularly strong in prostate cancer, but I know all the new drugs coming down the pipe in my little specialty, but even then I don't even do pediatrics. Again, it's amazing CME to push me way ahead and basically puts my partners in a situation where they can rely on me to say, this is the cutting edge or we need to look at this
process.
Well,
we have always done the same thing in our practice. So this is not just abstract research. It has enormous clinical consequences in terms of elevating the level of practice.
Well, I think of the things I've done that I'm really the most excited about and the most proud of and the most cutting edge and how I've affected my partners is in the realm of prostate cancer and particularly on a patient of mine that years ago had a problem with osteoporosis. And I remember Dr. Rost coming up to me and saying, gee, Paul, this guy's on fire. Why did you throw gasoline on his fire? You've given this guy a worsening osteoporosis problem. There was nothing in the literature, and I didn't understand that androgen deprivation therapy for prostate cancer equals significant bone loss. And you know, in the early 90s, there wasn't a single thing. The first article to hit our journal was 1997. And by that point in time, I was already into starting to do clinical trials in osteoporosis. And now a decade later, and this coming year, we should see two drugs approved specifically for the indication of bone loss associated with androgen deprivation therapy in men with prostate cancer. We're the cutting edge of how do you follow people with bone loss. You know, we have our own decks in the office. We now have our own bone program. My nurse practitioner is lined up to see these people. And people are coming to me saying, what should we be doing for monitoring these men? And bone loss is going to be the first of a number of factors that we're now understanding that many men who receive androgen deprivation have not only issues with bone, which is the easiest thing to measure, but they have issues with affecting their lipids, their blood pressure, their diabetes, which contributes to, we think, increased cardiovascular death. And although we've made a few steps forward with understanding the role of androgen deprivation therapy in prostate cancer, we've got one step backwards because we're poisoning them with our treatment because we don't pay attention to the details like osteoporosis and cardiac issues.
Well, we won't go into details about that now, but I will remind the audience that in our vitamin D issue, where we had an entire issue of the journal devoted to vitamin D, we have an article by you on osteoporosis and prostate cancer. So the last thing I'd just like to ask you to do is to just speculate about where you see this going in the future. More of the same? More support from government, maybe? Less support? Drug companies don't have money to throw around anymore? New drug development is not quite as active as it used to be?
You know, I see it almost going to all private money. Until the point comes where there is absolutely no reward for the home run drug, which at least in the short term still seems to be there, it's all the venture capital, private funding of research is going to continue to drive it. I see government funding, particularly in the current financial crunch that we see happening, I see that drawing up to next to nothing. And I think that's what's driven us, is that in my particular discipline, there were a lot of new compounds that came forward in urology. All the studies were pretty much funded by the drug companies, and I don't see that changing. And I see them also going to the private sector, to someone like myself, because we're much more nimble than the academic center. They have a hierarchy to go through in terms of getting studies done. If you look at our typical prostate cancer clinical trials as an example, you'll have a couple of name academic centers on the study, and all the rest are someone like myself, and they also come to us not only because we have nimbleness, we can rapidly do the study, we have the patients, which is important, and we're the guys who are going to be writing those drugs when they come to market. I see the future as continuing to be robust because I have diseases that have a lot of unanswered questions, particularly prostate cancer, which in the next 10 years is going to become what I believe is a chronic illness. And when you have a chronic disease with an escalating number of patients, will generate a lot of interest from people looking at what angle could we get in on this marketplace to come up with a new solution, because we're still lacking in solutions for prostate cancer in particular.
Well, this has really been a tremendously interesting conversation, and not only interesting, but also I think it contains some messages and hopefully some inspiration to some people in our audience to get more heavily involved in contributing to medical knowledge, even though they are in private practice. So thanks again, Paul, for being with us today.
You're welcome.